This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, what perfect timing. I have Michael Murphy. He is the founder of the Right to Rise PAC, a conservative PAC that raised $100 million for Jeb Bush and conservative causes. He has been the campaign manager for people as diverse as Arnold Schwarzenegger, governor of California, Mitt Romney, governor of Massachusetts, and presidential campaign candidate Jeb Bush, who ran for the nomination of the Republican Party in 2016 and did not make it. The timing of this is perfect. He is not only a conservative and a very successful political campaign consultant and advisor, but he is a person who has been watching elections for a long time. Full disclosure, he is a member of the Never Trump group, who think that Donald Trump is not the ideal candidate to be president of the United States. I found this whole conversation to be quite fascinating for two reasons. First, we booked it 6 months ago having no idea what would happen in the campaign, because I thought we were booking Michael Murphy, the technology newsletter writer, and I thought this was going to be a opportunity to geek out about all things technology, software, telecommunication, etc. Instead, we got lucky, and we got the guy who is really an extremely influential person in the Republican Party. So that's number one. And number two, at the time we booked this, we had no idea who the nominee was going to be. We had no idea about anything that was taking place on the political side. It's a pleasure to speak with somebody who is incredibly skilled about political communication, about the way elections run, about the way successful campaigns do certain things or don't do certain things. All told, the timing of this could not be better. This will broadcast before the first debate, the first presidential debate. And it was really absolutely fascinating conversation about the state of politics in modern America. So with no further ado, here is my conversation with campaign consultant Michael Murphy.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My special guest today is Mike Murphy. He is a Republican political consultant. He advised Florida Governor Jeb Bush in the current election. He previously has advised such luminaries as Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, U.S. Senator John McCain, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. John McCain privately called him Murphistopheles, so that should give you some sense of his ability to foretell the political future. He is a commentator on NBC's Meet the Press and The Today Show, used to write a column for Time magazine, and served as a fellow at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government's Institute of Politics. And is, I think I could safely say, you're pretty much recognized as one of the GOP's most successful consultants and innovators. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I own that until we lost the Right to Rise Super PAC for Jeb. Now I'm going to be a retired, formerly one of the great consultants, but I had about 29 winning statewide races, and that got me pretty established.
Mike Murphy, welcome to Bloomberg. So let's jump right into your background, because I find it absolutely fascinating. You're not even out of college, you decide, hey, I could, at age 20, launch my own political consulting company. How did that happen?
Well, luckily it's an unregulated business. Mm-hmm. So I was going to Georgetown. I was in the Foreign Service School. I'd grown up in Detroit, and I thought, wow, am I going to wind up in the auto industry? Which was kind of appealing, but I was really interested in international relations and politics, so Georgetown was the place to be. I was involved in the College Republicans. I was all about politics. And I got this internship at the old NCPAC, the National Conservative Political Action Committee, mm-hmm. which had invented the independent expenditure, where a third group could run ads. And so one day they fired the ad agency and they said, anybody here know anything about advertising? And I had been like, around a radio station a little bit in like high school. So I, of course, said, me, I'm an expert. And one thing led to another. And they said, because it was low production budget stuff, all right, kid, make an ad. And I didn't know what to do. So I called up this ace producer who it turned out later had made one ad in his career named Alex Castellanos. Mm-hmm. And out of that came Murphy and Castellanos. We started making ads for these horrible low budget campaigns because nobody else would hire us, but some pack work. And we got lucky on a thing or two. And so I took a leave of absence my senior year. I gave up being yelled at in Russian every morning by Colonel Pirogov, the defector who was trying to teach us Department of Defense Russian, which way to the tractor factory. Would you like some nylons for a picture of that factory? And kind of ran away to join the circus of campaign consulting.
So what was the lucky ad that was the big launch? Which was the first one that you said, hey, we got something here?
Well, we did some kind of fun stuff for these independent expenditure campaigns mm-hmm. in the early 80s. But then it was the 86 campaign when Alex and I really officially, got together. We were working for this Senator Steve Sims out in Idaho that everybody thought was going to lose.
This is a by-election between presidential elections.
Right. An off election. But still, they had the Senate races in 86. It was a tough year for the Republicans. We were these young guys, and Sims won. And some congressional races people thought would lose, we did pretty well in 86 and 88. That put us on the map. And Alex and I went off, and we had a great run. We did a bunch of stuff. And then in the mid-90s, we had probably the only amicable split up of a political consulting partnership. We're still very close. He went off to do a lot. You see him on CNN. He's mm-hmm. a big-time Republican consultant. And I had a good run, particularly with governors, blue state governors. I worked for John Engler in my home state of Michigan, mm-hmm. three-term win there. I worked for Terry Branstad in Iowa about his 40th term. We got a re-election there. The Jeb Bush race in 98, I did those statewides. Christine Todd Whitman in Jersey. I just, had a great run of
I'm picking up a theme here. These are all pretty moderate GOP governors. Is that a coincidence or?
Well, people keep calling me a squish, which is the Republican word for moderate, but I'm a pretty right-wing guy. I work for Ali North. I mean, I had plenty of, Alex came out of the Helms machine down in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. But I believe in the kind of conservatism that can win a swing state, which is something that's kind of been lost in our party now. So I consider myself pretty conservative, but I'm not what we like to call a paleocon. I'm not
paleo-con.
A Buchanan Republican. No, no.
Huh, that's really interesting. So let's talk a little bit about your PAC, Right to Rise.
Mm-hmm.
This was looked at as a juggernaut, a huge money-making machine. Who is the typical Right to Rise donor? Describe them. I'm not looking for a list of names.
Sure.
But what sort of person is this? Give us some demographics.
Well, the way it kind of works in the system now is you have a campaign for president, but you're limited under law to mm-hmm. take a limited amount of money only from people, not from business entities. So you can take your $700 or whatever from an individual. All the campaigns, therefore, at least most of them, would create a super PAC, which can raise essentially unlimited money.
Mm-hmm.
So often your donors who might give you the what we call the maxed out federal check to your campaign, which is relatively small, would also give to the super PAC. So we were very successful. And the one campaign we won, and really Jeb won, was the donor campaign, where you travel around the country, meet people,
right,
and convince them to back you, not somebody else. I mean, the people who gave to us, many of them also met with Governor Walker when he was in the race, with Senator Rubio, with Senator Cruz. It was a competition, and Jeb had the most compelling vision. So the typical person, some were longtime party fundraisers who might write us a check for $100,000. We had, a lot of those, or $50,000. You had a few of the real kind of super donors of the party who could write. I think our largest donor was over $2 million. Mike Fernandez, a healthcare executive down in Florida.
That's a big check.
Yeah, it's a big check. These are successful people. Sometimes it's private family-owned businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're folks who just have always had an interest in politics, and some were new. And there were people generally who knew the governor, many from when Jeb was governor of Florida, where he was very successful, or liked his vision, that we weren't going to run a grievance campaign about who we're mad at.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to run a campaign in the primary that we knew would be rocky, but we'd do it in a way where we thought we could win a general election. The primary voters wanted something else, so now we've got a candidate who is very strong in the primary, but is in real trouble, I believe, in the general election.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My guest today is Michael Murphy. He is the founder of Right to Rise. Is that right?
I think my title, and you know, we folded the pack down. We returned about 18% of the money, or excuse me, about 12.5%
That's a good return, 18%.
We returned our capital, but let's put it this way. Nobody else has ever returned a dime in politics, and we gave back millions of dollars.
And what was your title with the Bush
CEO.
Campaign?
CEO. I was CEO of the Right to Rise pack, which has now been wound down except as a legal entity because we get all the FEC audits after the election.
Gotcha, you have to keep that around. And then in the Bush campaign, what was your title?
Well, I was Jeb's kind of senior strategist when he was running for governor. Under the law, when in the presidential, when you're doing the super PAC, you cannot legally talk to the campaign or
it's
the candidate.
It's one or the other. You can't
you have to pick.
That's really interesting. So let's talk a little bit about this, the primary season, which was really kind of wacky. So really, it kicked off for me summer 2015 with the Fox News-hosted GOP debate. And it was shocking. They came right at Trump right out of the gate. In hindsight, it looks like that approach backfired quite a bit.
Well, Trump had a constituency that was willing to put up with a lot of heresy from Trump. In other words, he could do things that were considered impolite or rude or offensive, like attacking John McCain. Most people thought under the typical political rules, and I did too, that would hurt him. It didn't among the third of the vote that really liked him. The other two-thirds, not so sure. Even today, Trump by no means has all the Republicans lined up. But in a multi-way campaign with 15, 16 candidates, if you can hold on to a third to 40%, that's a ticket to the end.
That's huge.
What happened.
And
yeah.
Everybody doubted him far, far, far into the process. And in my mind's eye, when he went on Jimmy Fallon, and did that mirror bit when the two of them are, you know, it's Fallon pretend. And he was, so I know of him as a New Yorker. Full disclosure, I think he's an amusing guy, but not presidential timber. But at that moment, I turned to my wife and said, this guy can win. This guy can win the primary. It was just, and at the time, I don't think a lot of people really felt that way.
What most people thought, and I think the people running just about all the campaigns, is that Trump would be an interesting sideshow, but he'd fizzle out because there was another candidate who would get what we call the grievance vote, which was very large this year.
The
blow it all up, hate everything, mad, who's the enemy? And that was Cruz. So most of us thought the real threat to the nomination, who we were very worried about winning, was Ted Cruz. But Trump managed to kind of out-muscle Cruz with that big persona. Trump was also what the Hollywood people in that business would call a pre-aware title, which is when you're making a movie now, you go spend $400 million, and the marketing department comes up to you and says, well, we could make, you know, Flowers of Ralph and spend $400 million explaining what the movie's about, or we make Iron Man 11. And you don't have to have the same marketing lift with Iron Man 11. That's why they're making movies called Battleship or, you know, these known titles.
One title, you know exactly what it is.
Yeah, and Trump was a known title. Now, even if all he was doing was teaching Gary Busey how to work a snow cone machine, he was on primetime TV every
all
week forever
right.
in a set, which, by the way, is now the location of the campaign headquarters set. Uh-huh. It's all this new kind of politics where pop culture's crossed over. But that created the identity where he was this super business guy on television, can-do, fire him. That persona, he was ratings. It is the news business. So he got more attention than anybody. And that grievance formula, which Jeb Bush would never go to do because one, that's not
persona,
who he is.
Right.
It's not who he
Clearly
is, not what
not.
He believes in. And Jeb knew that Trump's going to lose the general election. You know, the worst thing you want is to have a primary, which is a drunken bender, where you wake up the next morning, you've blown a presidential election. And that's what I believe we've done.
So the parallels between 2012 and 2016 are similar. Nobody really gave Trump a shot in 2012. He went not that very deep into the process, got a lot of brand recognition, capitalized it, and by some analyses, the bulk of his fortune came about post-2012. People will argue about that. But what made this primary so different? And to be blunt, I thought the 2012 run of folks, other than Mitt Romney, was far crazier than this run of folks. I mean, you had just, that was, not me, but other people have called it a clown car. And it was apparent, at least to some observers, that Mitt Romney was going to come out of that ahead. we didn't quite have the same dynamic happen this time.
No, by the traditional yardstick of folks who'd done stuff, we had a very heavy field. We had some big governors.
This primary.
Yeah, this
time. As opposed to 2012.
Yeah, last time, I think Romney's a very serious guy.
Yes,
I worked
absolutely.
For him. I did his governor's race. But there were also some sideshow acts running. This time, it was the candidates weren't as crazy, but the voters decided in the Republican primary to be crazier. And you can see it on the Democratic side, too, with Bernie. There is such a populist revolt
yes.
going on in the country. The middle class hasn't gotten a raise in real wages in a long, long time.
Right.
And people have been mad at the political system now for a decade. They're fed up. They want to blow the whole thing up. I did Schwarzenegger's campaign for governor of California. And I remember Sacramento in that race for governor when the voters of a Democratic state reached in and yanked out the guy they just elected and threw him out the window in a recall
right.
election
right.
was the same kind of anger. The difference is Arnold took the job really seriously. He got the best policy people he could, starting with Warren Buffett, to work on a big plan for what to do when he was governor. That's not Trump. He's pure seat of the pants.
You know,
but the anger is the same.
People look at Arnold as if he's just a big, dumb actor, but he's not. He's a smart guy. He's a savvy businessman. He owns a ton of real estate. I'm not surprised that he did exactly what you said in California.
Yeah, he's shrewd. He's a planner. Arnold's always thinking about what's around the corner.
A few steps ahead. Yeah. Now, it's not a surprise that in 2012, in the midst of the financial crisis, the public didn't have much of an appetite for a private equity guy.
Right.
But what do we think about in 2016? You have a career politician on one hand, then you have kind of a renegade on the other. Which way is the public going to break?
Well, the force that pushes Trump forward is what we political types call the wrong track, which is 2/3 or more of the people think the country's off on the wrong track. That means the election is going to be about new change, blow up the system.
Right.
And that is the wind that Trump can harness. Hillary is stuck being politics for 40 years. She's a pre-aware title, too. Everybody knows who Hillary Clinton has. They have for decades. But she represents, oh, my God, the old politics. Now,
right.
the countervailing force, though, one is Trump's weaknesses. Trump's got a lot of Trump-driven problems. He
right.
ran a campaign designed to offend swing voters that he needs to win the general election. It's like he was built in a lab to lose the election.
Bad strategy.
The other problem Trump has is demography. The election scale in the general election, those 129 million people, is increasingly a much more Democratic group than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
30% of the voters will be minority voters, Black, Latino, Asian, or mixed race. Among that group, Trump right now is losing by essentially infinity. So he's written off almost 30% of the vote, the 80% of which will probably go to Hillary, maybe more.
So let me ask you this question on that
problem.
Exact topic. So if you had to come up with a percentage, let we start with the Electoral College map and we look at everybody who went out and voted for Romney, what percentage of Mitt Romney voters are just going to say, I'm not going to pull the lever for Hillary, but I can't go vote for this guy? What percentage of 2012 Romney voters stay at home?
Well, I don't know about stay at home because there are other places they can go. We got the Libertarians. They vote, but they don't vote in the presidential. They vote down ballot
right.
in Senate races or House. But let me put it this way. I think Trump will lose at least 10% of the people who pulled the lever for Romney.
And that's something like 50 million...
Well, that would
million.
Be, it's a couple million people, put it that way.
Less than what Romney's 57 yeah, or 58,
but he may bring in some people Romney didn't have too, you know,
uh-huh.
so there are two numbers there. But fundamentally, if you look at this polling, and there's constantly panic about polling,
mm-hmm.
because the media business has to cover for eyeballs every day of the election like it's the Hindenburg explosion.
Sure.
No matter what happens, it's the biggest thing in the world.
We only hear about that one outlier poll, not the
oh,
other
yeah.
99 each day.
The sirens go off because they need the daily heat. That's where the clicks and eyeballs come from. So they're in business too. So, but if you look at the last 30 days of the polling, give or take a day,
mm-hmm.
and you average it all together, which realclearpolitics.com will do, the Trump number has basically been 41, 41, 41, 41, 41, 41, 42, 41, 41, 42, 42, 41, 43, 43, 43, 42, 43 times 5. He's been stuck down there because
uh-huh.
he's in this demographic cul-de-sac where he's not getting what he ought to of college-educated white people, which Republicans normally win. Romney won him by 14 points.
Right.
Trump's
the
up
Democrat
by 3,
has 4. Not. The Democrat in a presidential election has not won white college-educated males in I don't know how many decades.
Right. And so he's in trouble there, particularly of white college-educated women who really are the most powerful swing vote.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing great with blue-collar white guys. He's
an increasingly doing okay small with, pool.
Right. A shrinking pool. And he's getting murdered by the 30% that's minority. So Trump is stuck in this low 40s cul-de-sac of demography. The reason the race looks close is when the media only covers horse race, 42-42.
Right.
Well, 42-42 is the voters saying, we hate both these guys.
Right.
Because a bag of cement can get 40 with a D on it, and a bag of cement with an R on it will get 39. So the question is, the difference between Hillary's 42 and 49,
right,
or Trump's 42 and 49 or 50, who are those people? Well, they look a lot more like Democrat-lean voters than Republican.
Mm-hmm.
So the real action of this race has been Hillary going from the high 40s and, oh, she's way ahead, to Hillary doing something stupid or having a bad week
pneumonia,
in the campaign.
Whatever.
Yeah, when they keep it a state secret. Pneumonia
right.
is suddenly the new nuclear code. You can't tell anybody for 7 hours after you face plant into the Scooby-Doo
right.
van there on television
right.
for the whole country. It's insane. But they get in trouble, and the polls are basically a noise meter of what was on cable TV four days ago.
That's exactly so true.
And so they tick down. So there's kind of a VIX of polling going on, and it's mostly Hillary moving around. Trump's creeped up from 41 to 43. But he's running out of voters.
Right. And give him time. He'll find a way to
he'll offend him again. Eventually. Like, again, today in the news cycle, he's out, you know, attacking more people.
The birther thing.
I can't believe that.
I thought that was behind us. I'm astonished that came up again.
He's, I think, working on something today where he's going to try to get out of it. But, you know, he gets out of it, then he gets back in it. So,
right. He can't help himself.
Yeah. The question is, can Hillary fix herself just to get to her generic number?
Right. And that's enough for her to win.
She would win because the generic number for them is bigger than ours now.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is GOP campaign strategist extraordinaire Michael Murphy. He has advised pretty much everyone on the GOP side, from Jeb Bush to the governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, to Mitt Romney, to McCain. You were big with McCain in 2000.
I did the 2000 campaign. I didn't do 2008. And for Mitt, I did the governor's race. People always hear my bio and say, so you're the idiot who lost. No. I did the Straight Talk Express, which did lose, but boy, do we have fun.
Let me ask you a question about that.
Governor.
So I'm an odd political duck growing up in New York. Jacob Javits, Republican, socially progressive, fiscally conservative. I loved the 2000 John McCain. Wholly unimpressed with George W. Bush. Here's a guy telling the truth, the straight shooter. He was, and then in 08, that guy disappeared. What happened there?
Well, I think he was the same guy, but he made the tough decision that everybody in politics eventually has to make, because it's a tough bracket. And it is, boy, I'd actually like to win the election so I can do some of this good stuff I believe in, because he's the same guy. And now I've got to be the standard bearer of the party. Last time I got to run against the party and we had fun, met girls, drove around the country in a bus. It was fantastic. And we almost stole the election. You know, we had it. We were halfway out of the bank and there were just a few too many cops. The second time we tried the robbery, maybe we actually try to get out with the cash. And so when John ran the second time, he ran a little bit more of a traditional Republican campaign. And guess what? He won the nomination. But it was not enough to win a general election. And I think one thing that hurt him a bit in the general was he'd lost a little of that appeal he had to cross over voters. That
sure.
was so much a part of what we did in 2000.
He lost that. The financial crisis teed him up. That was really, there was the let's suspend our campaign and rethink this.
Yeah.
And that was the point where it's pretty much he
And
fell
he was
off
up against
map.
History of Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And the fact is, the media loved McCain. I used to joke the media was our base.
Uh-huh.
But what the media really wants is a Republican martyr. Boy, he gave it to him, and then they beheaded him. So who's the Democrat we're going to be for?
My personal thesis is the Iraq war was going bad. The financial crisis was a disaster. As long as the Democrats put somebody up who could form coherent sentences, it was their race to lose. That was a really uphill battle
and
for Republicans.
And the Obama phenomena, I'll never forget. You know, I'm still close to McCain. He's a great American, one of the most impressive people I ever met. And I went and visited him.
You like, it's okay that he was captured? You were right with that?
Yeah. I know a lot of details. I met some of the guys who were in the Hanoi Hilton with them. Or
I'm
McCain
sure
would
they're
joke,
horrifying.
I stayed in a hotel once where they don't leave a mint on the pillow. Well, Donald Trump, you know, I mean, the deferments alone could go on for hours. Trump just disgusts me.
Let me take off my independent hat and put on a Democrat hat for a second. Hey, how much of this is just karma coming back from the Swift boat debacle? Is this, can you really complain about that? And I remember McCain defending Kerry, to his credit, was not a fan of the Swift boat stuff. But the party apparatus that approved the Swift boat, is it a surprise that it devolved into this?
Well, I don't know. I'm never a big believer in pulling the sweater thread of one campaign thing, because then I got to go back to LBJ using an H-bomb to terrify the country about Barry Goldwater. So I do think the political culture has gotten coarser, but Trump is an outlier. Trump is breaking rules of basic civility, let alone the truth. He is the fact check meters in the press have exploded. He broke the machine. I mean,
how
it's
do you fact check a person who tells no they truth? Say is an outlier.
And everything's a pivot. He's a Republican one day, he's a conservative, then he's a liberal. Because he doesn't believe in anything. Like any good con man, he's just trying to get the room.
Are you suggesting that he's a grifter? Is that what I'm hearing from you, Murphy?
I can't say he's a grifter, but I think he has griftish tendencies.
Griftish tendencies. All right, we'll see if that makes it into the campaign. So let's talk a little bit about the Jeb campaign. How surprising. I mean, it looked like this was Battle of the Dynasties. It was going to be Hillary versus Jeb. How much of this was just the forces you talked about earlier, that it was the anti-incumbent, and how much of this was he just was rusty and off his game?
Well, the voters are always more important than the campaigns, because they decide what they want and they go find it. And often what they find takes a while. So they go land on somebody. And then, of course, everybody's shocked and amazed at what happened. But it was clear it was going to be a grievance primary. And one of the great secrets of the Jeb political operation is we were bluffing a little bit.
In terms of what?
We knew how hard the Republican primary would be.
Oh, really?
For a positive candidate like Jeb. Yeah, but you don't run a campaign saying, hey, guess what? We think it's really going to be uphill. You run a campaign saying, we've raised the most money, we have the most qualified guy.
We're inevitable.
Be for what's going to happen. We were trying to muscle Rubio out, Kasich, others. That was the strategy, because you don't lead with your weaknesses. But internally, I'll never forget, I had dinner with Jeb and Sally Bradshaw, who's Jeb's other longtime political person, a dear friend of mine, and his son. And I won't go into a private conversation, but we all did the odds of winning early on when we were thinking about this. And the guy who had the lowest number at the table, and none of us were over 50%, was Jeb. And we said, well, then, I have an idea. Why don't we order another round of drinks and not run for president? And Jeb said, if I don't do it, if I don't try to run the kind of modern conservatism that can win the general election, get power to change the country with our policies to lift everybody up, that's why we call it Right to Rise, who will? I know it's a long shot, but who will fight the good fight? We're going to get Cruz otherwise. Or, you know, we'll get another grievance candidate. Trump wasn't around at that
point. So no one really was thinking, oh, Trump is the guy that's going to
steamroll
everybody.
Trump wasn't on the radar then. We were much more worried about, the kind of forces in the party that picked Trump in the end, but we thought they'd grab on the Cruz, and we'd run a grievance campaign, the Republican Party, and we'd blow the general election, we'd hand the White House to Hillary Clinton, who's eminently beatable, and we'd set the party way back at a time when we needed the opposite, and the country needed our ideas, at least our Bush conservative ideas, which is about fixing a lot of things that don't work in the country with free markets and other things we believe in. So we always knew it was more of a crazy long shot than anybody thought, but we could never say that publicly, because it would undermine our attempt to muscle our way through. Now, that said, Jeb, if he were here, would be the first to say, I was rusty out of the box.
He was.
I was not in perfect candidate shape, not at all. But, I mean, people say, well, would you have done anything different? I can say, I can think of 100 things we would have done different, and we would have lost differently. You know, it's weird. I'm in a business where you live by winning and losing, and I've been spoiled. I won a ton of campaigns over the years. Had some losses like everybody. You learn a lot in your losses. You actually learn more than you do in the wins.
The same is true in the world of investing. You walk into a casino, you win. Hey, you're a genius. But when you walk out, you lose. It requires a very different bit of self-reflection.
But I can tell you, the Jeb folks, even though we had the resources, thank God for that. Jeb worked very hard. The finance people did. We had a great team, many of them here in New York. So we had the dollars to make our case, but they were not buying what we were selling. So weirdly enough, even though we all hate losing, believe me, so pathologically, we sleep pretty well, because there's nothing Jeb Bush did in that campaign we have to apologize
for. He ran an honorable campaign. He bowed out at the appropriate moment. He didn't overstay. There's not a lot of things you can really...
Yeah, we weren't talking about Mexican rapists. We weren't lying to people. Trump's tried to steal our immigration plan on days when he's for immigration reform, which is about one out of three. You know, so fought our corner, fought it hard, worked like dogs, Jeb in particular, and guess what? We lost. Life will go on, but if, as I think the numbers are going to show, that Hillary Clinton will be sworn in as the next president, you know, am I going to be saying I told you so a little? Damn right.
So let me ask you three questions about Jeb that really stood out. The first was very surprised that he was seemingly unprepared for a question about his brother's administration, the Iraq War. That kind of surprised me that that wasn't off the tip of his head, top of his head, tip of his fingers. Did you? I know you weren't working directly with the campaign.
Well, I was around then. That was before I went to the Super PAC. That was a situation where we all knew from minute one what the answer the press wanted to hear to say he's, quote, answered it right. You know, because the press judges.
And what's the right answer?
Oh, it was the worst thing ever. And, you know, oh, it was
we made a mistake. We should have stayed in Afghanistan.
Terrible mistake. The problem is, like a lot of governors, Jeb had written a lot of letters, made a lot of phone calls to people who had their loved ones killed in action.
Right.
Fighting for our country. And he wasn't in a big hurry to say, yeah, it didn't mean anything. And so he, again, what would make him a great president, but did not always make him the perfect machine tool candidate, was he pushed back for a few days that he didn't want to like run to bury the sacrifice of people by trying to separate that from just the policy mistakes that were made. And he did say policy mistakes were made, but he didn't leap to it with glee the way the media narrative would like. So what does that mean? It means you get scored as bumbling idiot for 4 days by the process press, the same people who are hyperventilating today about polling data as Trump becomes the president of September 18th. You know, so again, I draw analogies to the business world. This is a lot like value investing. And the daily panic, the daily herd is something you have to resist strategically, but it rules the press.
So it's a voting machine short-term and a weighing machine
long-term. Yeah, and if you can figure out the net asset value of an electorate, you're going to do well.
So second question related to the Jeb primary. Donald Trump comes out and Jeb says, well, you know, my brother kept the country safe. And then Donald Trump comes out with what is not just a Democratic talking point, but a far left talking point. September 11th happened on your brother's watch. Your brother didn't keep the country safe. I'm in New York and 3,000 people died. That's unheard of amongst Republicans. And what was the reaction to that?
Well, in the room where it happened, he was roundly booed. Trump was. You know, he was clobbered in the debate. Yeah, yeah. And we, you know, contribution surge, all the normal stuff.
Really?
But, again, Trump was the creature at the beginning of about 25% of the primary electorate.
Uh-huh.
And then it grew to the mid-30s. And they were ready. I mean, we tested all this stuff. We'd do polls and focus groups of Trump voters. And they were locked in. They were like,
no matter what he said.
I don't care.
I mean, a GOP candidate has never said anything like that.
Yeah, but he was not. And this was the big surprise to those of us, because the last 1,000 times you've done a campaign, the ideological primary voters vote ideology.
Right.
And, you know, Trump could be wearing a Karl Marx suit, and the 25 to 30% that he really had, they wouldn't go anywhere. They're like, look, he's my guy. He gets the issue, and then you'd feel the race in the room. They would not quite say it, but the little thing was, he knows what the problem is, if you know what I mean.
Wink, wink, whistle,
wink,
whistle.
Wink, so I don't care what you fancy pants college jerks say about him with your whatever he said in 1989. He's my guy, screw you, and you know maybe some of you guys will get thrown in the camps. I mean, it was rough. There are some rough voters out there in Trump world. Now,
well, he came out and said, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and my people are still going to support me. That's you're saying that's true.
Yeah, and that was the core of the core. I want to be fair to most Trump voters here. I blame the con man, not the marks. I think there are a lot of people who are for Trump. The vast majority love the country and really think he is a way to change it for the better. But back in those primary days at the beginning, there were some rough elements in that world, and they were ready to take almost any rhetoric from Trump, and some of them really loved the roughest rhetoric about the Mexican rapist coming in and all that. That was
that's
part
why
of
that
his
resonated.
Equation. Yeah.
So the last Trump-related question with Jeb, he has aside from the fact that he's a talented television presence and personality, he has a way of crazy Bernie, crooked Hillary, little Marco, lying Ted, and he came at Jeb with low energy.
Right.
What was the reaction to that? Because Jeb stands up there, and you're not supposed to be doing a dance at the podium. You're supposed to be articulating intelligent policy positions.
Right. What was a code word? You know, I was screaming at the TV. I couldn't talk to the campaign, but how about needy Donald?
Right.
You know, because there's no needier person
narcissist
in American
right.
political life. The low energy Jeb, one, people who know Jeb all went nuts because he's not
a low energy guy.
If Trump was on Jeb's schedule for 2 days during the primary, Trump would be in the hospital.
Right.
But he's
the healthiest presidential candidate ever. That's what we're told.
And he's the Energizer Bunny. The 25-year-old staff couldn't keep up with him, the workload, when he was governor. But it wasn't about low energy. That was a code word for smarty pants talking with the big words. When I'm going to tell you what's really going on, Mexican rapists are coming over the border.
Uh-huh.
Well, Jeb's talking about, well, it's an act of love, frankly, when they come into the country to try to get their families a life as an American. Jeb was civil and polite, and that was a code for low energy.
With Spanish members of his family.
Yes,
of
yes.
course he's going to push back
yeah,
on that.
Yeah, so that was Trump's code for
other.
Jeb uses big words, and, you know, he doesn't have my grievance anger. And so it really meant polite and thoughtful, which was, frankly, not what 40-some percent of the primary wanted this year. I joke it was like selling opera records at a tractor pull. They just weren't buying it. And it's too bad, because if Jeb were a nominee right now, or I'll say in fairness, casake, we'd be up 3 or 4 in Hillary on our way to win the election and probably get the Senate reelected.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Michael Murphy. He is a Republican political consultant, most recently known for the Right to Rise Super PAC. He has advised Jeb Bush, Mitt Romney, Arnold Schwarzenegger, John McCain, and now runs a fabulous podcast called
Radio Free GOP.
Radio Free GOP. You can find that on iTunes and pretty
Stitcher,
much everywhere
all
else.
The usual places. Yep.
So let's jump right in to the general election. What does the Trump campaign mean for future elections and non-politicians?
Well, it's interesting because we have this crossover now, pop culture into politics. We had a little bit with Arnold back in 2003
for sure.
in California, but this is a whole new level. I'm terrified a Kardashian right now is looking at a map of New Hampshire.
But didn't we've had Sonny Bono, we've had
There's been
athletes,
some, yeah.
we've had the guy from
George
Love
Murphy
Boat.
Way back when, the
right.
actor, Ronald Reagan was an actor originally. So,
oh, of course, that's the ultimate pop crossover,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. I actually did the campaign in the primary against Fred Grandy, who was the mm-hmm. guy from the Love Boat. He ran for governor, and I'll never forget poor Fred. We ran a radio campaign when we found out he'd been a liberal Democrat in Hollywood. Fred Grandy, he may be a better actor than we think. So the actor thing actually became an issue in that primary where we were able to beat him with Governor Branstad. But he was a pretty distinguished Republican congressman for a long time. I do think we're going to see more crossover, and there will be kind of Trump imitators, but it's hard to imitate Trump. One, he is so pre-aware and so uh-huh. famous, and two, his blustering style, which both helps him by attracting attention and hurts him by offending voters he desperately needs to win a general election, is a hard thing to replicate. But so, he's put his claw print on this, no doubt about it, and it will be felt in the future.
So you've worked with the media and through the media. What is the media circus of a presidential campaign like? What does the average listener at home not know about this mayhem?
That it's a big mob that watches itself. So there's a huge herd mentality,
mm-hmm.
and it's running against a clock of now, now, now. Because what digital media has changed is the old days where you had the deadline at night and then the paper, and now the news cycle is instantaneous. Twitter, you know, the various social media platforms, it never ends. So they mm-hmm. they are like a herd of buffalo running, looking 1 foot ahead, just watching each other, thundering toward anything. The old joke I used to tell, which is kind of unfair to my friends in the media, is they're kind of like the Jurassic Park dinosaur. They're, you know, 40 feet tall, 5 foot teeth, and a brain about the size of a grapefruit. And when they see movement, they want to go sniff it and eat it.
Mm-hmm.
So when something happens in the campaign they see as movement, you know, this herd of Jurassic Park dinosaurs, they thunder over and probably destroy whatever it is with investigation. So whatever the movement of the day is, be it the candidate falling in an orchestra pit or Trump creates some phony trip to Mexico, they thunder and cover the hell out of it, because every day has to be a big day to go. Now, to give them some credit, there are stronger, more important themes and analysis that does happen that kind of floats above. But I would say they've been a bit flummoxed by Trump, because the old media weapon of the raised eyebrow, well, that's really not quite true, sir. That used to send most people in public life to like, well, I, you know, and back off. Trump's oblivious to it. He just doubles down on whatever misstatement he just made up. And they haven't quite found a way to push back because the rule book is they can't say, that's a bald-faced lie, you con man.
Have you noticed?
They're trained not to do that.
I've noticed that CNN, of all stations, is running on the crawl
like
a real-time fact check. No, what he said isn't true. That's unthinkable with any other candidate.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like it's the World Heavyweight Boxing Championship, and one of the boxers walks in with a chainsaw and starts slicing at the other guy, and the refs are saying no, and he slices the ref, and the crowd's screaming.
The thing doesn't stop.
Yeah. It's like, but wait a minute, you've just broken the rules of, there are no rules, and then the ratings go through the roof, and maybe there are no rules.
So let me flip the question on you. What does the media get right? What sort of coverage have you seen that you've said to yourself, hey, this is really insightful?
They do two things really well. One, even though it is an insane herd, and a lot of the analysis I see on television drives me crazy because it's so ill-informed
and
silly. They cover it round the clock, wall to wall. So if you want to know what kind of tie Donald Trump is wearing today and the words he said, just clip on cable TV or the internet. So it's, you're there. And they use the technology and the resources they have to put you in the campaign. You can actually cover the campaign now without traveling, really, even as a journalist, because it is so accessible electronically. So you have an unfiltered view of the whole thing that you've got to sort out. The problem is there's a lot of bad, dumb analysis. But we get a level of kind of transparency into what happened that day that is unheard of 15 years ago in politics, even 10.
Who is doing the sort of deep dive research that impresses you? What have you seen that stood out?
I would say
out?
That's the second thing. There are some people who are old pros who are writing smart political coverage with context to what's really going on, not the daily trivia chase. I would say in the print side, Jonathan Martin at the New York Times does a great job. There are others there, Maggie Haberman, a bunch of their, they do, it's a left-wing newspaper, but the news folks covering the analysis side of the campaign, I think there are some strong people there. The Post, there's a great beat reporter who covers
the charity issue.
Yeah, right.
I don't remember his name. He's called like 400.
Yeah, Farenthold, I believe. I'm mispronouncing
it. How brilliant is this? This guy has called like 30 charities a day. Have you received any money from Donald Trump?
The Post,
he's found one $5,000 donation out of,
they've
it's
done
amazing.
A great job on that. Bob Costa is a good shoe leather campaign gossip who's fighting who in the elevator, what's really going on. He's one of the few guys, deep sources in the
inside
in the,
baseball,
the banana republic of the Trump campaign.
Right.
There's no campaign. It's a banana republic. And a lot of the things they say about what's happening are not that true. And he's well sourced there. I think Dan Balls has always been the thoughtful, big picture slowdown. I've seen a lot of elections.
And he's where?
He's at the Post.
Mm-hmm.
Ron Brownstein at the National Journal is probably the best guy in demography, which is always the motor of what's really going on.
Sure.
If you want to kind of read the balance sheet of the candidates with the reality of who really they're probably going to have in the end. If, you know, to use the investing analogy, Brownstein is very good at that. And, you know, there are others. I mean, I'm being
unfair. What about
unfair.
The new media like Politico, Vox, BuzzFeed, Vice, any of that stuff stand
Glenn
out?
Yeah, Glenn Thrush at the Politico, I think, breaks some stuff. I'm generally not a political fan because they're often in the trivia and gossip business.
Uh-huh.
They're kind of the Hollywood Reporter, the old Hollywood Reporter of politics. And so they'd really like to know who's fighting over the cafeteria menu in the campaign, and they're quick to blast stuff out that's weekly source sometimes.
So sometimes
they get it right. So I don't want to be too unfair to them.
So let's talk about the campaign nitty gritty, because you just dropped something I want to follow up on, that there isn't a whole lot of campaign there. I keep reading that Hillary has this massive machinery, and they have 50 offices in each of the 50 states, and the get out the vote and all that sort of stuff. They run like a finely tuned machine. And he seems to be spending money in Virginia, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
By all the conventional rules of this, Hillary has the big, complicated campaign with the massive staff doing all the traditional things. She's like the dog food company with the best satellite aim trucks, jingles, you know, sung by Lassie. She's got everything. The only problem is you crack open the dog food, the dogs sniff it, and they whine and run the other direction. So, but she has all the machinery and distribution, and that is worth something. Trump has no campaign. He has a couple of yes men who circle him and yes women, but it's all Trump. And the mechanics of the campaign are an advance operation, because what Trump really wants is somewhere to land the plane, somewhere to have a hall full of an adoring throng to cheer, uh-huh. and he'll do his routine. He kind of does this like stand-up Don Rickles meets whatever he is, Juan Perón. And you know, that's the whole Trump campaign. So when Trump has a big idea like, hey, I'm going to go to an African-American church and take on Hillary, great media chum. You know, oh boy, cat bites dog, Republican and African-American community, they're covered the hell out of it. But you need a real campaign operation to go find an African-American church where a pastor is willing to let you do a political speech, which, by the way, actually happens all the time in churches. But
not supposed to,
you need
but it
a
does.
Depth of field to figure that out. With Trump, the advanced guys come in and say, all right, this will be his hold room. Here's the special meatloaf. Here's the coffee. Here's the signs. And they find out, they pick a pastor who shut him down because the thing was not, they couldn't execute it well.
Right.
And so at any question of execution, be it policy, be it a digital campaign that means anything for, you know, the mobile devices that are increasingly the front window on so much in communication, including campaigns, all that stuff, they got nothing. They're doing a few polls. They got people trying to talk him into saying, they got like 1.5 speech writers who can put him on a prompter that he'll ignore half the time.
Right.
But it's like a bad congressional campaign level of technical competence.
How important is, so he has this huge Twitter following, and I will admit his tweets are amusing. Sometimes they're
I want to figure out who writes them.
Well, you could tell it was BuzzFeed said when it's at the bottom of each tweet, you could see was this tweeted on an iPhone or an Android device. It turns out that when it's on the Android device, it's his staff, and when it's on the iPhone, him. And you could see one is very clearly angrier and a little more bullying, and the other one is a little more circumspect and a little more.
I think he just
correctly
yells down
spelled.
The hallway, probably to Hope Hicks, who's kind of his press valet.
Uh-huh.
And send out a Twitter, you know, and he barks out something, and maybe she tries to clean it up a little.
So, but how significant is Twitter to the national campaign? Is this something that the inside baseball people like and are really impressed, but the public doesn't care about?
Well,
or is Twitter affecting the election?
Twitter is a very fast electronic bulletin board that all the reporters use to kind of watch stuff. I'm at Murphy Mike, and I do it all the time. I've got over 50,000 followers, and I've never said my Twitter handle on television. It's kind of weird. It just organically grows.
Sure.
But you also get a lot of people who are just, they think they're digital warriors, and so they're barking at other people. And there's a lot of kind of graffiti on Twitter.
That's what the mute button is for.
Right. No, exactly. My favorite thing on the Twitter feed. I love throwing people off the island. I figure they don't pay to follow me. I get to fire them whenever
hey,
I want.
People who are annoying get muted. People who are intellectually dishonest, I block and leave it at that.
I kill people who do. I don't kill. I block or mute them when they do bad puns. I'm
so tired
of stupid, unfunny puns. That's a real Bush League move. You know, it's like, really?
Done. See ya.
Yeah. That, you know, work a little harder on the jokes. So Twitter is a good way to get a message out quickly. But in the mass voter world, the other social media is much more powerful.
Facebook
and increasingly Snapchat and some of the other, even Pinterest. Because what Facebook does, and all the social media does, is they take credible information and they move it sideways. In other words, we have a thing now called the virtual precinct. In the old days, you have a precinct captain going door to door, and you'd know the guy two doors over. Oh, yeah, he's a veterinarian. He'd come over. Look, I know your wife's big into animals. You have this candidate. Now the virtual precinct is your best friend from college who's the teacher in Columbus, Ohio, is everybody as much in contact with you as your friend two blocks over.
Mm-hmm.
So the precinct on social media, those swing voters in Columbus may not be getting their information from the Columbus regular Republican or Democratic organization, but from their friend from high school who actually lives in Riverside, California, who may take an article that really persuaded her that Hillary is bad, click a share, and then the person in Columbus will read and trust their friend who sent them the clip, and that information will go sideways and have a huge impact in a precinct 2,000 miles away from the person they have the social connection with. And it's really changed political organization.
So that raises an interesting question. In the 08 election, it was clear that the Obama campaign had a much more technologically sophisticated approach than either Hillary did or McCain did. He seemed to really have that core group of Google geeks that he brought along and became his secret weapon. And what I've been hearing, and especially in the postmortem after 2012, was that, hey, the GOP really has to catch up to the Democrats on this. And it doesn't seem to have happened this cycle. How important is technology relative to what it used to be? And is this lag between the Democrats and the GOP as sizable as it was? And when does the gap close?
It is sizable, and it is a huge problem. But one caveat, we always obsess on the gadgets, you know, in the campaign. Oh, the new mind-reading polling device or this or that. I ran a guy, a long-shot guy for president in 1995. We announced the campaign on CompuServe. We hold the record for presidential campaign launched on the web. But you can overdo the technology. The truth is in 2008, when Obama had much better analytics and digital than the McCain campaign, which was Stone Age, you know, just mm-hmm. It was the Keystone Cops. The Obama campaign would have won without the internet, because the big narrative storytelling of the campaign and the demography, the most powerful forces, were all lined up with Obama.
What about 2012? Is the same true?
I think the same. Let's put it this way. It is a huge, campaigns are amplifiers. And all media, be it radio, paid television, direct mail, telephone calls, and of course everything digital, particularly mobile devices, which are eating everything, mm-hmm. is a powerful amplifier. And the analytics you can get by knowing what people are interested in helps you learn so much more about the voters and be so much better at even doing the television. It's all true, and the Democrats are way ahead. But some of that is not by choice. It is driven by the audience. The Republican primary, our core tribe, uh-huh. is old. So guess what the dominant media is? AM radio.
Oh, really?
Which, with all due respect to Bloomberg Radio, you know, I know you
we're
probably
on AM.
You know, 10 years from now, you'll probably be streaming. We're not sure AM radio will be carrying.
This is streaming already.
Right,
so,
exactly.
So not only is this, so here's the technology,
and
just
the
to
Dems,
give it context.
It's definitely the internet, because they're younger.
So this broadcast, this will go out on radio. It'll be streamed on
right.
Bloomberg.com. It'll be rebroadcast on Sirius XM. It'll show up on iTunes. It'll show up on SoundCloud.
Right.
It'll be in a dozen places. But you're saying the core GOP voter is a little older. They're watching Fox News. They're listening to AM radio. They're probably right. reading a physical paper, not something online. So those demographics, how big of an issue is that?
It's a
and
huge
when does
issue
that change?
Because our center of gravity, our audiences, our core audience mm-hmm. that picks our nominee, they tend to gravitate toward yesterday's media because of age.
Sure.
So we're really good at AM radio, which is probably the least important thing to be really good at if you plan the next 10 years of American politics.
It's been, listen, Rush Limbaugh, and there's a
right.
whole crow.
Mark
people. They've been really, really effective.
Right. And they're on the web too. I mean, they're branching out. But my point is, it's kind of an illustrative joke. Our activists gravitate to AM radio. Their activists gravitate to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So guess what? They're much better at the internet.
Sure.
Organically. But we our problem is not technology. After that report came out, which I agreed with, I would have loved to have been a big iron salesman selling computers to the RNC, because everybody wants to buy the gadget.
Uh-huh.
Our problems are more fundamental than the gadget. Our problems are modernizing conservatism to appeal to the demography of the modern America so we can actually win a presidential election. We have lost, you know, we're the market party. We believe the market's smart. We've lost the voter market in 5 of the last 6 presidential elections. That's 20 years of our product being rejected by the consumers of a presidential election. The only group I know with a longer than 20-year losing streak like that, this is true, is the Washington Generals, who were paid to lose to the Harlem Globetrotters. Their losing streak is 24 years long, so when Trump blows it, we can turn pro. We'll be able to join the Washington Generals.
So we've been speaking to Michael Murphy of the Right to Rise PAC and political consultant to Jeb Bush, John McCain, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and other, and host of Radio Free GOP, which you can find at iTunes and
Stitcher,
everywhere else
YouTube,
you're fine.
You name it. Yeah.
Podcasts have been found. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and stick around for our podcast extras, where we keep the tape rolling and continue chatting all things political. You can read my daily column on BloombergView.com or follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Welcome to the podcast. Mike Murphy, thank you so much for doing this. I have to share a hilarious story with you about how this interview came about. So I have a booker, Taylor. She does a fabulous job. And we're always, you know, there's always 3 dozen people in the process of either them reaching out to us or us reaching out to them. I'm not going to be in New York until November, whatever it is, and it's a process. Your namesake, Michael Murphy, was on Bloomberg TV the same day you were on either by all due respect or one of the shows.
Huh.
So I send an email to Taylor saying, oh, Mike Murphy was really good. We should get him on. She goes, okay, not a problem. He's back in New York in September. Fantastic. So I go about my day and I don't think about it. We prep for these about a week in advance. I start doing research and I ask somebody, I don't know if it was you or the press person, hey, send me your bio. We'll start our research. And back comes Mike Murphy, Right to Rise, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you thought it was the Silicon Valley guy, right?
4 months ago, I thought it was the tech guy. So I tell Taylor this. And she goes, what do you want to do? I go, this is fantastic. The election's a month and a half away. I have a million questions for Mike Murphy.
Oh, that's funny.
Yes, by all means. So this was a fortuitous.
Right now, the tech guy's on Meet the Press.
That's right. I wonder how often that happens. So thank you so much for doing this.
I'm happy
very
to be
excited.
Here. And most of my work is working for business, by the way.
Oh, really?
You know, yeah. I don't really do campaigns anymore. I do corporate problem solving and public
affairs. So is it crisis
like
consulting or specific
some
marketing?
Some crisis and also, you know, messaging. Politics teaches you how to punch a message through. And
on
how
a product
to tell
or
a
on
story.
A specific?
Both services. I do work for HP Enterprise. Uh-huh. I've done work in the past with Facebook and, you know, a whole bunch of
so
well-known
HP.
Companies.
So Carly Fiorina, what was that about?
Well, she's, you know, great presentation, ambitious, and she's now looking at running for chair of the Republican National Committee.
Really?
Yeah.
You think she has a shot?
I think she'll lose if Reince Priebus runs for re-election. He's got a pretty good grip on it, but maybe. Yeah, she's got a lot of fans in the party.
What happened to her campaign?
Well, I think she never really had the base to run for president. It's hard to run for president when you're
gotta be a
last
governor
story
first.
Is you got clobbered in, you know, admittedly right. A very hard state to win.
Right.
She ran courageously in California like Meg Whitman did.
And not a so Meg Whitman has a great reputation from eBay and I forgot the products company she was at before. Was it Colgate-Palmolive or something like that?
I think she was at PG&E.
P&G, that's right, Procter & Gamble.
Yeah, PG.
But so she's got Meg Whitman has a wonderful corporate resume. The Compaq HP merger, people aren't as excited about, and I think Carly has less of a of the business cred than
the
Meg Whitman.
The California business community did not really fall behind Carly the way they did behind Meg,
right?
When they both ran, but I give them both credit for running in an incredibly hard state to win as a Republican.
Sure.
And now,
if you're not Arnold Schwarzenegger,
doubled down. Yeah, but Arnold was like a hybrid. He could, you know, he had that big identity, so he can kind of bring everybody together. And it was a recall election, no Republican primary. So unlike both,
oh, that's right,
Meg in particular, Meg had an anti-immigration guy running in the primary, which really hurt her in the general election.
That's an issue in California, much more so than New York.
Yeah.
I'm surprised homelessness isn't as big an issue in California. As a New Yorker,
right.
Going to California, you go to L.A., San Francisco, or straight up the coast, Portland, Seattle. As a New Yorker, I'm shocked at the amount of homelessness.
Yeah.
San Diego, it's shocking. It's surprising.
An issue that comes up on polling, but California politicians don't talk about it.
Why is that?
Well, I think we're a one-party state, and nobody wants to kind of get into the identity politics arguments with the interest groups that say more money to the homeless versus kind of the groups that are more of a tough love approach.
Uh-huh.
And so they don't see a political win in jumping in the middle of that.
Utah did an analysis, and they said, we could take these people, put them in public housing so they get their meds, so they...
Well, it's interesting. I was in Utah 2 days ago, and a couple of mayors straightened me out about that because I asked them about it.
So
and
enlighten me.
The media got it wrong. We did a thing for veterans. We could take care of the veterans that way, but the whole community now... Homeless are coming to Utah from around the country.
Get out of here.
Believing that there is a part. Yeah. I had
so this was for homeless vets, not for the general
that
homeless
was the
population.
Initiative. And I had the.
And it's
the
been very successful.
The city councilman from Salt Lake kind of explained it to me. He said, my theory is we have a growing homeless problem because we became famous as the place where come to you, there's an apartment for you. And that's not quite accurate.
Well, sure. The homeless get online. They read this on the internet. Are people really traveling across country to go to Utah for free?
I'm not the fact checker on it, but I had a credible Utah's municipal official tell me he thought that story had attracted more homeless to
but
to
the fact that it was homeless vets that's what the
that
actual,
was the program yeah
okay
and he thought that was a distinction that should be made
that makes a lot of sense so Let's talk a little bit about the general election and things people don't understand. If you were to share with the public, here's something you probably don't understand about the entire campaign process, what would that be?
I would say, one, it is a human endeavor. So all the eccentricities and wonderful things that make humans unpredictable are part of the campaign. It's less of a machine than people think. And eccentrics have a role in it. Second, people way overestimate the importance of daily polling data. I often joke that if I woke up one day and they said, hey, welcome to China, you have a new job, you're head of the Chinese spy agency, I would say, okay, I guess I got to do this. Give me the budget. And I'd immediately take about $20 million and I would start buying off pollsters in the U.S. Because 90% of the pundits you see on television, the experts, quote unquote, who, if you notice, have to be an expert about everything, so often they're an expert about nothing.
Right.
They look at the average of all the polls every morning and then they engineer opinions to fit that. And so we're in this kind of silly feedback loop. The truth is it's a lot more like value investing. You want to identify the balance sheet of each campaign, the real assets that are there, get through the accounting blur, and not worry about the daily vicissitudes of polling, which have a lot to do with what was on the news 2 days ago, and see who's getting what assets from the electorate. Who's doing well with women and women are going to like and land with? Who are college-educated versus high school-educated men going for? Where are minorities going? And then you can pretty well know the reversion to mean that'll happen on election day.
That's so funny you say that. Literally, my column that September 16th is about we overemphasize the most recent data and ignore the long-term trends. These daily things are so noisy. They're so subject to revision. You were mentioning 41-43. You could have 100 polls at 41, but the one poll that comes out and says 46,
right,
and when it's against the overwhelming weight of the evidence, the assumption is, hey, that's the poll that has something wrong with it.
Right.
That's the one everybody runs with. It's the one that makes the news.
I have a friend who's an old retired journalist who says, if a Martian landed and watched only television, they would think that gerbils can water ski, because the only time you've seen a gerbil on TV, it's on water ski. So therefore, gerbils must be, the outlier gets the attention.
Yes. And that creates
I'll defend a little bit. They are right when they overreact to these polls that the race has tightened a little bit. But they assume that it's kind of like the psychology of the stock market. People assume the current direction will always continue.
Right.
It'll keep going up or it'll keep going down. So
trees don't grow to the sky. You can't extrapolate that way.
Exactly. And so when I look at the election, I've seen the new Zonker poll. Here's everything I know. Polls are hard to take because people don't answer their phone anymore.
Right, for sure.
So the methodology is harder, which means to do it right is more expensive and takes more time in the field. The average media publisher doesn't always say when I'm buying a poll, can I get the most expensive, really good one that takes a week to do? They're like, I need an instant poll tomorrow to have Candy have something to talk about on the morning news flash.
Right.
So, you know, the pressure to provide cheap, junky polling to consume, to feed the trivial discussion every day with the sirens going off. We have a new action poll.
And now it's a closer horse race because you were using mediocre polls.
Well, not always mediocre. I don't want to have too broad of a brush, but let me put it this way. The election is more complicated than daily polls, and the big trends that you want to figure out don't always reveal themselves in the poll. And finally, everybody covers the horse race of the two numbers. One guy's at 45, one's at 44. It's a one-point race. I'm saying, well, who's not yet at 49, and what does the next 5 points look like to get there? Because the people who are undecided are not going to leave the planet. Almost all of them will vote if the poll is correctly done of registered voters, and they're going to land on somebody. So even though it might be a two-point race now at 42-44, there's another, you know, easy 10% of the vote that's going to show up and be for somebody. And that's a much better understanding those voters and where they're going to land or likely to land tells you a lot more than 44-43.
Are there really undecided voters at this point in this election? So let me push back on this. This show, and it has been a reality show, this has been going on for well over a year.
Yeah.
The Brits have an election. It's 6 weeks and they're done. And I think the Canadians are 30 days. This is a year of this. Is there anyone out there who really doesn't have a firm opinion on, I like Hillary, I don't like Hillary, I like Donald Trump, I don't like Donald Trump? I mean, at this point, what is the big reveal that's going to affect them? Or are they just being a little coy?
They're being a little coy. because we, in the old days, you know, like the Gallup poll or Harris, when the polling phone call came, you'd stand up. It was like the president calling. It's, you know,
oh,
Dr.
It's Mr. Gallup.
Yeah, it's a big deal. Oh, now we have a poll every 2 seconds.
Right.
So there's some political science thinking that says people use polls to kind of slap the system around a little bit because everybody knows they get to change their mind. So when if you were to, like, the electorate, people who say they're for Hillary might for a week say, oh, I'm thinking about Trump. Nah, I'm back to Hillary.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of like when you ask somebody what kind of car they're going to buy. Well, I'm thinking this is the year for the Mercedes. You know, if you ask them 6 months before their lease is up, and they're going to float around a couple of car brands.
Right.
Half of them will stay, like base voters. They're not going anywhere. I'm a Chevy guy, always been a Chevy. But others will float based on what they're seeing out there. Mm-hmm. But if you pull the same people 3 days before they buy the car, they're down to a price offer.
Right.
And the Mercedes is now off the list because they found out that, oh, it's going to be $300 more a month than I thought. And they're heading for that Ford Fusion or whatever. So, you know, just because they say it on September 17th doesn't mean it's what's going to happen in the election. It tells you what would happen if the election were held yesterday. That's
so,
what polls do.
So we've seen polls in the past that famously Carter was ahead, what was it, 9 months, 8 months before the election? And going into the primaries early on, it looked like Obama had no chance in 2008. When do the polls really begin to firm up? It's mid-September. We have, what, 7 weeks left?
I don't know any serious practitioner, which means people who spent 20 or 30 years running races, living in crap hotels and campaign headquarters for senators, governors, congressmen, and occasionally presidents, who pays too much attention to the horse race ballot until after the first debate. And that means early
October.
Which
is the end of this month.
Yeah, so early October. Mm-hmm. And until then, it's like me handing you an apple, some sugar and some butter, some flour, and say, what do you think of my apple pie? You know.
Not ready yet.
Yeah, you have to cook the thing. And so do we follow polling now? Of course we do. But you don't really look at the horse race. You look at the internal numbers. What do they think of Trump? What do they think of Hillary? What do they not know about Trump or Hillary that you know as a consultant is true? Because the main thing we do in a campaign is introduce new information. And that is a powerful thing.
So that's a really interesting set of questions. And let's unpack that a little bit. First, in a stage with 12 people, Trump was a tremendous debate presence. That worked out really well.
Right. Pre-aware title. And remember, the electorate in the Republican primary is only maybe 29 million people, which is 100 million fewer than the general election electorate. So one of the things that's happening now is people are saying, well, nobody thought Trump could win the primary, and he won the primary, so wet streets cause rain, which means Trump can win the general.
Right.
They're two totally different electorates. You know, it's
so heading into the general debates for the general election.
Right.
What's your read on how he's going to behave and how he's going to do in a one-on-one debate versus what he did in the 12-person debate?
You know, it is impossible to predict Trump. It's just, you know, the only thing I'll say is, you know, Trump will be Trump.
Right.
Which means he'll careen around. He'll vamp everything. He'll, 1 minute he'll try to be thoughtful and quiet. The next minute he'll be talking about Vince Foster. What the mix is of that, you don't know. I mean, the joke I tell about Trump is the Trump advisors are kind of like Charlie Manson's Foxtrot instructors. Charlie, today's Foxtrot lesson. Great. Step, step, tap, step. Steps. He does it. And then he does another one. You're thinking, wow, he's making real progress. Then he stabs you in the eye with a pencil. So you can't predict Trump other than he will be unpredictable. That's the prediction. And we will see versions of what we've seen before because people don't change. So whether it's a mix of the more subdued Trump they occasionally get because they've got the Thorazine out or whatever they do, or it's Trump totally unhinged, or both during a debate when kind of crazy Trump breaks out of the Thorazine Trump after 30 minutes when, you know, he can't put another pill in. Who knows? Now, Hillary, we do know because her personality is so transparent. She'll try to win the spelling bee. Call on me. Call on me.
Right.
I wrote a paper on that.
She's a policy wonk and she'll be wonky in the debates.
So the real question will be when Trump kind of tries to bully and muscle in on her, how she handles that without doing a bad Trump imitation, which would not help her.
Right.
But she can't be too passive either. So it's a tougher debate for her because she's
got to thread that needle.
She's got to navigate the crazy while still showing strength because he
is a bully.
She's got
to be strong and likable and experienced. And I don't love her, but I could live with her. Is that what she's going for?
I would say, from her point of view, I would be thinking about, how do I move the needle on the number one, the kind of thorn in the voter's toe about me, Hillary, which is nobody trusts me because they think I'm an ultimate political calculating machine. So how can I break through all the political crack and get people to think I'm a real person, I have stuff I believe in, which is why I'm in this, and here's what I'll do for you. How does she get that connection done? And how does she appear strong enough that Trump setting his hair on fire, you know, 6 feet away, does not affect her in a way where people say, you know what, she's just not strong enough.
Right.
Trump, meanwhile, if he's smart, has to know to win the election, he's got to take one of two groups and dramatically change what they think about him, which is the hardest thing to do in politics, get people to totally change what they think. He's either got to get minority voters to change what they think, or he's got to get college-educated white women to go from not liking him to loving him. And does
that's
he have
a
the
big
tone
challenge.
It is a lift I've never seen anybody else do. And Trump is not the kind of guy who does discipline lifts. He just shows up and he still thinks it's the Republican primary. And so I think he'll do his act and he'll hurt her a little. And because I don't know how good she'll be. I'm very worried she'll be overprepared and all that from, again, very worried. I'm not voting for her. I'm not a Hillary Clinton fan, but I can't vote for Trump.
But aren't you kind of in the never Trump campaign?
I never vote for Trump. If it came down to just my vote, I would probably jump in the lake, but I'd leave with my suicide note a absentee ballot for Hillary Clinton. Because if I had to pick, her mediocrity is so much better than Trump's venality.
I mean, within the range of acceptable politicians, she may not be your cup of tea, but you know that she's a serious candidate.
She won't try to get out of NATO. She'll actually be 10 or 20% better than Obama on foreign policy and national security.
Really?
And that's my guess. Those are the issues.
And on the
I
economy,
the
what's your view of her on the economy? How far has Bernie dragged her to the left?
Dangerously far. The hijack team of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are a threat, and they're a tragic one because the policies they're pushing her into, and she has plenty of her own bad instincts here, are going to hurt the people they want to help the most. It's going to be murder on the working poor because what's going to happen? Growth's going to drop. And with that, there will be no upward pressure on wages. And the people who are barely getting by right now are going to get a worse deal.
Now, let me push back on you a little bit. The most recent data on wages came out. It was the best numbers we've seen in a while. We're still below the 1999 highs, but the gains over the past 12 months have fallen mostly to the middle class and the poor. That's very different than the past 10, 20 years. Some of it is the reduction in poverty. Some of it is the lowered number of people without health care or health care insurance. And some of it is just, the cycle has now gone far enough that when McDonald's and Walmart have to raise their bottom wages to attract employees, we're pretty close to full employment at this point. So the pushback is, this is working and we want to continue letting it to work. So go with me, Hillary, who will continue these policies, as opposed to Donald, who's going to do who knows what. How do you respond to something like
that? Well, we are starting to see some wage growth and the economy is showing some strength. I agree with that. But her plan appears to be more redistribution, because she doesn't want to face the hard question the next president has to face, which is we can't afford the entitlement state we have.
Mm-hmm.
So her plan is, we're going to make the rich pay more of their fair share so I can have my cake and eat it too. I don't have to touch entitlements, which are a ticking fiscal time bomb. I can tax more money, which will have a chilling effect on the economy, and I'll keep having growth that way. I think the only real kind of Keynesian growth plan she's got that's different than Obama, she's talking about infrastructure spending. I'm actually for infrastructure spending because I don't hate the idea of borrowing money from the Chinese at,
zero
interest, right. Maybe negative interest rate if we really skunk them, and build things that enhance American productivity. But if we don't
give me a for instance on infrastructure, where would you spend? I totally agree with you, but preach to the choir. Where should we be spending more money on infrastructure?
There are two baskets. One is the basket of stuff we have to do.
But haven't been.
The water supply system.
Terrible.
Is terrible.
Vulnerable, insecure, and falling apart.
And if we don't start...
We have water mains throughout the country that are literally 150 years old and have never... built for 50 years, never been replaced.
And unless we don't like the idea of drinking fresh water, there's massive things to be done there.
Mm-hmm.
On the the other safety one is bridges. The Civil Engineers Society thinks one out of four D-minus. American bridges yeah. are unsafe.
Bridges and tunnels, terrible. Right, in the totally.
And then on the productivity increasing sign are ports. On the West Coast where I'm from,
man, are you preaching to the right guy?
Our ports are going to be under real competitive attack from Chinese finance, Mexican ports tied into the high speed rail system in Texas.
Right.
And it is incredibly hard to get a can from the port of Los Angeles into the intermodal system now because we haven't really invested any money. The other thing we have to do, I'm a right wing nut, but I also know the facts and I live in Los Angeles. We lead the country in childhood asthma in the bowl around L.A., and the heavy sulfur we burn in the port is a big problem there. So my left-wing Bernie friends would say shut down the port. I would say give free electric hookups, you know, so they can turn off the heavy diesel there and switch to natural gas shuttle trucks. But that's dollars.
Right.
But all in all, the healthcare offset cost of having kids with asthma, not the humanitarian side, is even more persuasive. I would love to see a port revamp, and we could really use a natural gas terminal on the West Coast.
I'd also like to see
more American-made nuclear power plants.
Let me add that I want to see more exploration of the thorium plants, which is supposed to be the newer technology, not much cleaner. But let me give two little caveats to what you said. You know, we really haven't shored up our plants, our ports as much from a security standpoint.
Sure.
I mean, we inspect with Geiger counters and other checks for nuclear devices, something like 1 in 20 is one thing. And then the other thing is, you didn't mention, our electrical grid is very much antiquated. It's a patchwork. It's vulnerable. That's something else that from both a infrastructure perspective and from a security perspective, we're not doing it.
I couldn't agree more. The problem is, though, we need Davis-Bacon reform, because right now to build public works is about $1 billion a foot.
Right.
And that's how we rebuilt California. Governor Pete Wilson, after the earthquake, had freeway overpasses that had fallen down.
Right.
And
he got
to suspend some Davis-Bacon stuff. So everything.
What is that? Is that a?
It's the labor rule.
Okay.
I had a mayor in a western state of a growing community tell me I can build a highway for half of what the feds will spend because of some of the labor rules they have. So we meet it halfway. I think the Republican votes for infrastructure, and we're at a time now of low interest rates. I'm for borrowing money to make our physical plant the best.
50-year bonds at 3%?
Yes.
You could refinance a national debt and replace everything.
Totally agree. The other thing, though, is if we don't get entitlement spending under control, the other half of the equation, it's going to eat the entire budget.
So it's Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security.
Particularly Medicare, Medicaid.
I know I only have you for a few more minutes. Let me jump to some of my favorite questions I ask everybody, and I'll keep it really short because I know time's a-wasting. First thing, favorite books. What sort of books do you like?
I read a lot of history. I'm kind of a history nerd. I read a lot of everything. I'm a bibliophile.
Give me a few names.
I like the Ernest May stuff.
Ernest May.
Ernest May was a professor at Harvard, advisor to the Pentagon.
Give me a name of one book.
Well, Strange Victory, where he does all the war games of how the Germans beat the French when the French had the bigger army, and nobody thought, even when they run it at West
World
Point,
War
the French.
World War I or World War II?
World War II. The French win. He also wrote a great book, I don't remember the exact title, about how people argue with historical anecdotal evidence. Napoleon never attacked in June, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And how it affected bad policymaking in Vietnam.
That's fascinating.
How people misuse history and arguments. Ernest May, he passed away, but he was a giant in that field. So there's no such thing as a bad Ernest May book. In business strategy, I'm a Drucker guy, Drucker.
Search of Excellence.
Absolutely, just about anything you read. I'm a real fanatic. Search of Excellence being tops. I'm a value investing nut. My two favorites, I think, would be, well, both the Graham stuff, and I like Munger's stuff, too.
Sure.
And Seth Klarman is a friend of mine.
Oh, really?
I actually have a copy, a margin of
I safety. Have a PDF of it, but I don't have the physical copy, which go for like $3,000 on eBay.
Yeah, luckily he was a friend, and I cornered him in his office, found the drawer, and he sent me one. So,
that's fantastic.
But anyway, yeah. So I like that. I'm a big student of Cold War history because that's originally what I studied. So yeah, a lot of historical stuff.
And let me ask you my two favorite questions to wrap us up. So a millennial comes up to you, someone who just graduates college, and said, "Hey, I want to get into the political consulting game." What sort of advice do you give them?
I say, start out trying to run a campaign locally to learn politics. Don't go to D.C. It's not where you're going to learn anything other than build a network to get a job, but then you become a guy with a job and no knowledge, which is we have enough of.
You can get there later.
When in doubt, you want to learn politics, go work in a state capitol.
Oh, really? That's very interesting.
And, work for a state rep.
Our last question, what is it that you know about politics and campaigning today that you wish you knew 30 years ago?
Polling is overrated.
Mm-hmm.
Digital was not only going to become big, but it was going to eat everything, to quote Mark Andreessen. And that despite the flashy technology, including digital, never forget its narrative storytelling. And when in doubt, trust that more than anything else.
Mike, this
beginning,
has been...
Beginning, middle, and end, a story.
This has been really fascinating. The timing couldn't be better. If people want to find your writings or your radio show, they go to...
Sure, I got a couple of things. I'm on Twitter, at Murphy Mike. Radio Free GOP is my weekly podcast, which is a lot of fun. We're doing pretty well with it. And I've got a website that is... Needs to be updated a little, but I stuck all my commentary writing there.
And what's the URL of that?
It's called MikeMurphyCommentary.com.
So for those of you who have enjoyed this conversation, you can look Up an Inch or Down an Inch on iTunes and see any of our other 109 or so podcasts. I would be remiss if I did not thank Michael Batnick, my head of research, Taylor Riggs, our booker, Charlie Vollmer, our engineer. We love your feedback. And comments, you can send us email at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.